says consisting of 18 transcendental letters. The holy name consists of 18 transcendental letters.
Yeah, we talked about this one other week. It's that, I think it's that mantra, Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopi Janavalabhaya Swaha. And that's explained in the purport, I think. That's some, yeah, in the, if you look at the end of the first full paragraph, it says, as for example, Kling Krishnaya Govindaya Gopi Janavalabhaya Swaha. This is a hexagonal mantra consisting of six transcendental words, namely Krishnaya, Govindaya, Gopijana, Vallabhaya, Swaha. These six transcendental words, when placed juxtapositionally, indicate the mantra. But if you break down those words, it's Krishnaya, Govindaya, Gopijana, Vallabhaya, Swaha. Well, I came up with 17, but I must be doing it wrong. I should do it over again. But at any rate, that's what that's what Vaish was explaining when someone asked the same question about 3 months ago, two or three months ago. Hexagonal, six, they have, it's interesting. Let's read this purport. Text 3, translation. The world of that transcendental lotus is the realm wherein dwells Krishna. It is a hexagonal figure, the abode of the indwelling predominated and predominating aspect of the Absolute. Like a diamond, the central supporting figure of self-luminous Krishna stands as the transcendental source of all potencies. The holy name, consisting of 18 transcendental letters, is manifested in a hexagonal figure with sixfold divisions. Purport. The transcendental pastimes of Krishna are twofold, namely manifested and non-manifested. The pastimes in Vrindavan, visible to mortal eyes, are the manifested lila of Sri Krishna. And that which is not so visible is non-manifestive lila of Krishna. The non-manifestive lila is always visible in Goloka, and the same is visible to human eyes in Gokula, if Krishna so desires. So far, so good, everybody? He has his manifested and non-manifested. This is described in Krishna book also, when Krishna leaves Vrindavan, and everyone there feels separation. The idea is that he never really leaves Vrindavan. The real Krishna is always in Vrindavan, but he's in the minds of the devotees who are feeling separation from him. And he's also coming back and visiting him. So it's described that he has his prakata lila, which are manifest when they see him, and his aprakata lila when they don't see him. But they're still, because they're so attached to him as pure devotees, they're still meditating on him. So he's there for them in an unmanifested form. That unmanifested form is eternal, it's always existing. But the manifested form is Krishna's going from one universe to another universe to another universe and appearing and displaying his lila to call back the conditioned souls. Yes, it's really a replica of Goloka. So when Krishna comes and he displays his pastimes in the material world, he looks like he acts like a human being. But actually he's Krishna, and there's this very mystical manifestation of that which is unmanifested before the eyes of people who can't see that which is unmanifested. Normally, like it says, Shantaksadaiva Hridayeshu Vilokayanti, only Krishna seen through love. But sometimes he appears in the world, and when we see him, we're still seeing Krishna, even though we might not have the yet have the complete capacity to love him as the devotees do who exist eternally in the eternally liberated condition in the unmanifested realm. And that's also the same thing that's going on when we chant the Hare Krishna mantra, and this Sankirtan movement, when we're talking about these books, when we're speaking of the mantra, when we're distributing prasadam, we're bringing something that from the transcendental plane, the unmanifested plane, but it's now come to appear in the world. They say, what is it? Kali Kaler Nama Rupa Krishna Avatar. So Krishna's also appearing in this world and is manifesting his pastimes as the Sankirtan movement. And so there's something very mysterious there. Why is it that ordinary people who see with eyes and ears and hear with ears and see with the senses made out of material elements can perceive something which is spiritual and unmanifest, but it becomes manifest to us by the mercy of the devotees who are preaching the Sankirtan movement. So, in the Krishna Sandarbha, Sri Jiva Goswami Prabhu says, non-manifestive pastimes are expressed in manifestive Krishna Leela, and Goloka Leela is the non-manifestive pastimes of Krishna visualized from the mundane plane. So Sri Jiva Goswami Prabhu was nephew of Rupa and Sanatana Goswami. He was one of the important six Goswamis and the greatest philosopher of his time, greatest philosopher of all time, actually. And he took on this task of systematizing the analytical theology of Lord Chaitanya, and in particularly these six books known as the Sandarbhas, or known together as the Bhagavat Sandarbha. And so there's a Krishna Sandarbha, Bhakti Sandarbha, Tattva Sandarbha, Jiva Sandarbha. I don't know all of them. So this one is from the Krishna Sandarbha. He's explaining that non-manifestive pastimes are expressed in manifestive Krishna Leela. So they're expressed. So there's a what's going on in the world of Krishna. We can't really conceive of it in the non-manifested pastimes of Krishna. It's being described here in this book that there's eternal existence of transcendental time, which is ever-present and not subject to the quality of passing away for half a minute. And there's, you know, unlimited quantities of, you know, Sarabi cows, and the flute is the favorite attendant, and every step is a dance, and every word is a song. And that it's a little inconceivable for us in our present condition and mentality. But that non-manifested pastimes is being expressed in the manifest of Krishna Leela when Krishna comes to earth and displays those unlimited pastimes. And performs acts in Vrindavan. Yes? Microphone.
Here Krishna says, in the purport he said, visible to modern, that which is not so visible is manifest to Krishna. This line, the non-manifestive leader is always visible in Goloka, and the same is visible to human eyes in Gokula, means on earth. If Krishna so desires. So that means if Krishna desires, he can manifest the non-manifestory also to his pure devotees.
Yes. So, or no, even so he can manifest, if Krishna does, he can do anything. He can even manifest it in front of those who are not his pure devotees. His pure devotees, even when they're walking in this world, when we say pure devotees, I mean the fully realized, complete Mahabhagavata devotees. Then they're walking in this world, they're existing at two planes at once. They're present in Krishna's, they're always perceiving Krishna's unmanifested pastimes as well in their hearts. And then they're also dealing in this world to do some service for Krishna. Lord Chaitanya displayed how the devotee lives like that in his later pastimes. Then he would sometimes start losing external consciousness and out of his great desire to be with Krishna, great longing for to not be separated from Krishna. But then in the manifested plane, Krishna actually comes and he sends his different avatars over and over again throughout history. And he comes as, you know, Leela avatars, Shaktivesha avatars, Purusha avatars, Guna avatars that were described, that we're learning about in the first canto. And so when he comes and he displays his Leela in Gokula on earth, then even the demons can see him, right? And they come and they try to kill him and he kills them instead in these glorious ways. And he also shows how he protects his devotees and he cares for his devotees. Because he could just, he didn't have to, you know, the demigods go and they pray to Krishna, please come to earth and we're, you know, and we're being, the earth is being beset by demons, and it's, Krishna wouldn't have to come. He could just, in 1 minute, he could just make a brahmastra explode in all the demons' hearts, you know, if that was the way he wanted to do things. But that's not the way he does things. And Prabhupada said, he has so many agents, he could send any demigod, or earthquakes, floods, whatever, to kill the demons. So why does he come and display these glorious activities? Because he's actually displaying what's going on in the unmanifested realm of how he's exchanging love with devotees. He's giving us something to write poetry about, to talk about, to think, to meditate about, and to sing about. And he's attracting our minds so that we, conditioned souls, can return to the unmanifested realm where we, which is our real home. And okay.
Same thing, like the Bilvamangal Thakur, he had so, like, he like Krishna was serving Bilvamangal Thakur at some point, like in his life, when he was blind. So, does that explain, like, Krishna manifests the like non-manifested?
Yes, and Krishna can also come at any time to anyone. So he came, but when he came to Bilvamangal Thakur, yeah, he brought him milk and things like that. So he did things in this manifested world. Actually, everything that's going on in the manifested world, that's also the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam. Ritair tang yat pratyeta na pratyeta tatmani. We're going to recite those verses. But, you know, everything is manifested from Krishna. Even the manifested world is really a manifestation of Krishna's energy. And therefore, it's not different from Krishna. If we think it's different from Krishna, or if we think it's not connected to Krishna, then it's illusion. And so, Krishna, we could say in one sense that Krishna can always assert himself in the material world and have some actual influence in the material world. And in fact, he's more real than the material world. And he's sustaining the whole material world. Without him, there's no reality. So, yeah, so if Bilvamangal Thakur, if you know the story, then he was blind and he was living in Vrindavan. He lived for a long time. I'm thinking of Surdas. Bilvamangal Thakur was living in South India. Madhavendra Puri came to Vrindavan, and he was a Paramahansa. He wouldn't eat unless somebody offered him something to eat. He was just traveling in ecstasy, floating along. He didn't know if it was day or night. And he, you know, he sat down, and some little boy came to him, a beautiful little boy, village boy, came to him, and he said, "Why are you fasting? In my village, nobody fasts." And he brought him milk. He said, "My mother told me to come and, you know," or something. So there was this discussion. So this is a manifestation of Krishna. Is it manifested or unmanifested? I would say it's manifested because he actually brings him a pot of milk, you know, and then he has a pot there. He can break it off. But ultimately, everything is spiritual. And it's only material to the extent that we have, you know, we're learning about this Leela, Krishna's Leela, of how he manifests the material world. And he does. And there really is a material world that he manifests. And there really is this material energy. But he does it for the conditioned souls. Prabhupada would say that the mundane scientists, they have this idea that, you know, if you go out in a spaceship, like there's life on Earth, you know, there's some life on Earth because of some unusual, strange combination of matter by chance. But if you go out in a spaceship throughout most of the universe, there'll be this deep vacuum with no life there. Maybe there's life out there somewhere. There's this huge universe with billions of miles worth of billions of, you know, light years. One light year is already trillions of miles. And then there's, you know, stars that are so many light years away. And they wonder, is there any life anywhere there? Or is it just, you know, this, you know, combinations of dead matter separated by space of, you know, vacuum with nothing existing and stuff. And just anyone, you know, can understand philosophically, correctly, this is not true. This is not what's going on. The reason that matter exists is for the purpose of consciousness, for the purpose of conscious beings. There's, you know, like they had that philosopher in the 18th century, Berkeley, you know, everyone was talking about if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it, does it make a sound? But actually, you know that story, right? So, but he's explaining, actually, what happened, if I can digress a little bit, I've been thinking about this somewhat, remembering my old undergraduate philosophy days. You know, the Aristotle explained nature in terms of the qualities in nature and stuff. And then, you know, for example, they would say, in Aristotelian, they would say, opium has a dormative virtue. That means a power to put you to sleep. Things had different virtues. They had different qualities. And the whole sort of occult tradition of astrology and alchemy and things like that talked about how those same qualities were manifest in different planets and different elements and this, you know. And the early scientists like Galileo and Descartes, they were saying, well, we're looking at the wrong things, that really these qualities that we perceive, like smell and touch, taste of things and stuff like that, is just an accident of how they interact with our senses. So those are secondary qualities. But there are real qualities that are more real that have to do with things that we can perceive through mathematics. This was Descartes' big philosophy that was, for almost 100 years, he was the main scientist. It's a completely different science from modern science. But when Newton came along and he had a gravity and things acting at a distance, it destroyed the whole thing because they were thinking, we're getting rid of all this mystical stuff and we're explaining everything mechanically. And it's just, you know, things have shape. They have extension and motion, and all these things can be perceived through analytic geometry and the stuff that Descartes was good at. So he started to say that's the real thing. You know, when we talk about what's really there, it's blue because, or in modern, because he didn't have a lot of the modern optics and, you know, electromagnetism and stuff, but in modern parlance, we'd say, oh, you know, this thing is blue because certain wavelengths of light are reflected and then appear in our eyes as blue. So blueness is not a real quality of nature, but rather, you know, so many cycles per second is a quality. And, you know, so that was the thing. So Berkeley, who was an Anglican bishop in Ireland, was saying, you know, well, what about that? What about our ability to conceive of shapes and motion and extension and mathematics? That's also a quality of our own mind, right? You could say that, yes, smelling something is a secondary quality, but so is making a mathematical formula about the relationship of, you know, right? So he was saying, you know, when you talk about objective reality, that there's something that exists out there with no subject, with no person to perceive it, right? Then what does that mean? Or if there's no one for it to mean anything to, you know? So he was explaining that, you know, that anything we say about reality requires a mind to be perceiving a reality, and that's a fact. And then he said, so, you know, the answer was, well, you know, if a tree falls and nobody hears it, does it make a sound? And he said, well, someone is always there to hear it because God is always there. So God hears everything. God perceives everything. And because he's perceiving everything, it's real. And therefore, you know, we say, you know, Mahavishnu is there on the causal ocean and he's dreaming and in his dream all these things are happening. So therefore, there's nothing that actually happens with absolutely nobody knowing about it. Or what would it mean for it to be happening? Or what would it mean for it to be existing? So I went to my philosophy professor in 1982 or whenever it was, this English philosophy professor, Michael Williams, and I said, yes, this is this kind of, you know, what they call it, phenomenology, this idea that it's reality is what we're perceiving, you know, this kind of insight, this phenomenological insight, this radical idealism of, you know, that it's consciousness that really matters and that it's our perceptions of things that are primary. You know, this is already anticipated in Vaishnava philosophy, and he couldn't get it. He was saying, well, you know, because of his cultural prejudices, he was saying, well, they didn't go through the same, you know, process of coming up with this idea. You know, that's just mythology or something like that. But it's not. It's reality. And Bhaktisiddhanta knew it very well. And Jiva Goswami knew all this very, very well. But sorry for that digression. Sorry for that big, long digression. But it was something I was thinking about recently. But so what is manifested and what is not manifested? That the material world is real. But we don't know what it really is. it's really Krishna's energy. It's to be offered to Krishna. But because we're trying to, exploit it, we're trying to enjoy it, we're trying to bring it under our, we're trying to act like Krishna. We're trying to say it's our energy, right? I, me, mine. That's the false ego. So we're trying to treat the things of the world as things for our enjoyment. We're trying to become false Krishnas, false subjects, Purusha. Purusha is, the subject, the enjoyer. And Prakriti, his energy, is enjoyed. And we are Prakriti, but the position in material nature is that we're trying to be Purushas. And so we're experiencing material nature in a way that makes us miserable and bewildered. We think it's supposed to happen. We think it's supposed to bring me happiness, and then it doesn't. And our plans are all dashed when we get old and die. We're under the control of these things. But when we see things correctly, we can also see it's all Krishna. It's really Krishna. It's a manifestation of Krishna's energy. Prabhupada says, I'm trying to remember the formula, because the Mayavadis say everything is Krishna. And we say, Krishna is everything, but not everything is Krishna. That is, somebody may say, why bother worshipping Krishna? Why bother chanting Hare Krishna? Why not chant anything? Everything, because Krishna's everywhere. Krishna's everything. That's the Mayavadi idea. It's actually offensive to Krishna. They're envious of Krishna. They don't want us to worship Krishna. So if they don't worship Krishna, you may as well worship a stone, because the stone is also Krishna. Of course, anyway... But the idea is, no, everything is Krishna, but only the devotees can really see how it's Krishna. And the non-devotees, they're trying to see things as something for them to enjoy, or else trying to make it impersonal. It's all just Brahman, impersonal Brahman. It has no feelings, it has no desire, no volition. But that's not the Krishna that's described in the Vedic scriptures. And that's not the absolute truth that's described. In the Upanishads, you can twist them to make them look like they're describing that. But if you study them deeply, you'll see all the Vedas, the Vedic conclusion is really pointing to this. Vedanta Sutra is really pointing to this. That the absolute truth has senses. The absolute truth has will. The absolute truth has everything that we have and more. And the absolute truth is not a dead stone or a white light or a something that has no personality. Sure, one more.
In that comment that you said, the manifestive lila that goes from one universe to another universe, keep continuing actually.
Yes.
So there's a comment like sun keep moving from here to down, so it is somewhere. In the night also it's somewhere.
Yes.
So that is in that. So there are more Vrindavans like Vrindavan on this planet in the other universes? And
yes. We used to have the phrase, Prabhupada coined the phrase, it's like the traveling roadshow. Have you heard that expression? That somewhere right now, there are so many universes. We only know of this universe, right? It's like an egg, and Lord Brahma is there, and he's governing the whole thing, and Garbhadakshay Vishnu is there. But coming out of the body of Mahavishnu, as described in this Brahma Samhita, there are just as you can think as many pores of skin as you have on a human body. More than that, even Mahavishnu is lying there, and he has these unlimited pores, and out of each pore is coming one whole universe with its own Brahma, with its own Garbhadakshay Vishnu, with its own Lakshmi, and all the person and Krishna, somewhere at any time. Krishna is manifesting his lila in some material world somewhere. And, just as soon as he finishes pulling down the twin Arjuna trees in one universe, he's pulling them down in some other universe. So there's this constant traveling roadshow going on, but it's inconceivable to us.
Yeah, so question is, are they connected to the same non-manifestive lila? All of these Vrindavans are connected to the same?
It's like yes, it's all... It's all, and it's like I said, it's inconceivable to us, but Krishna he's really having his transcendental pastimes in the spiritual world that are being perceived and participated in by eternally liberated pure devotees. And it's said that, you know, there's unlimited spirit souls. You know, when we look around us, look at all the trees and the birds are flying around, there's insects in the ground, and there's just like so much life everywhere. And there's this unlimited conditioned souls struggling in material existence. But as many as there are, there's more than that, and maybe three times more than that. It says that it's like one quadrant of existence is material, and the other three quadrants are spiritual. Of course, they're both unlimited. And in that spiritual existence, there's that unmanifested pastimes going on according to the different devotees' moods and desires of interacting with Krishna, that this beautiful... that's beautifully going on. The theologians often worry. They say, well, why do bad things happen to good people? Or the atheists, they say, well, if there is a God and he's all powerful and he's all good, then how could he create a world so full of evil? But that's not the only world he created. He's got this whole giant expanse of creation, and it really is all good. But this world, the reason it seems evil to us is because we've turned our back on him. We're in this world of the place where people go when they're not participating in his creation. That's the Satchinandana Swami. He told this story when I saw him in Vrindavan in 1991. He told this story about how he was, you know, he's German, but I think he was in Switzerland. I don't remember exactly. He might have been in Zurich. And he saw the devotees out on Harinam, and they said, why don't you come back to the temple? And he came back, and they said, why don't you wash these pots? And he was washing the pots. And then he said, well, I'm going to go. And they said, oh, don't go. Our guru is coming tomorrow. So he said, okay, I'll wait, and I'll meet the guru, you know. So Prabhupada came, and he was going to the morning programs, and he saw Prabhupada, and he said the classes. And then he decided, well, you know, all right, so I've stayed, I've seen it, I'm ready to go. But he felt that before I can go, I have to go to the Swami and, you know, defeat him and explain why I'm not going to stay a devotee, you know. So he went up. I don't remember whether he had to get an appointment or whatever, but he went to see Srila Prabhupada, and he said, Srila Prabhupada, you know, I've been happy to be here at this temple, but I have this, you know, idea that if God is all good and if God is all powerful, then why does he create so much suffering and evil in the world? And Prabhupada said, rascal, you're creating it, not him. It's not that he makes it that way. You make it that way by the way you interact with it. And Prabhupada explained that to him so perfectly that he was completely convinced. Then he said, well, I can't go. So he became the great Satchinandana Swami, a wonderful devotee that's been preaching so well in Europe and elsewhere. So, let's read this whole purport, and then we have to get on with the morning program, unless anyone really has any more discussion. This is corroborated by Sri Rupa in his Bhagavatamrita. The progressive transcendental manifestation of Gokula is Goloka. So Goloka is the self-same majestic manifestation of Gokula. The eternal pastimes of Sri Krishna, although not visible in Gokula, are eternally manifested in Goloka. Goloka is the transcendental majestic manifestation of Gokula. The manifestations of the non-manifestive pastimes of Krishna with regard to the conditioned souls are twofold, namely, one, worship through the channel of mantras, inaudibly recited, liberating, self-dedicatory, transcendental sounds, and two, spontaneous outflow of heart's spiritual love for Krishna. These are the manifestations of non-manifestive pastimes. It's hard to understand. Sri Jiva Goswami has said that worship through mantra is possible permanently in the proper place when confined to one pastime. This meditative manifestation of Goloka is the pastime attended with the worship of Krishna through the mantra. Again, the pastimes that are performed in different planes and in different moods are autocratic in diverse ways. Hence, sva-rasiki, that is, spontaneous outflow of heart's spiritual love for Krishna. Srila Prabhupada said, Bhaktisiddhanta pointed him out. He recognized him. He said, he doesn't go away. He said, I couldn't always understand what Bhaktisiddhanta was saying, but at least I stayed and I listened attentively, and Bhaktisiddhanta recognized that about me. And he singled me out. Oh, he's very nice. He sits and he listens. Other people get up and go away. And, these writings of Bhaktisiddhanta are very high and difficult to understand like that. Yes.
I have a question. Golok and Gokul.
Microphone.
Goloka and Gokul are two different words, but meanings are the same.
What he's saying is, in this purport, he's using Gokula to refer to the place where Krishna performs his pastimes when he comes to earth, when he descends as his avatar, descends to earth, and can be seen by everyone, you know. And Golok is the planet where Krishna eternally resides, and it can't be seen by people unless they're actually completely pure, full of love for him. So the Golok is unmanifested, and Gokul is manifested in this world, even to our own senses. But, he's saying, the two are the same, actually. How they are the same. That when Krishna comes to earth and displays his pastimes on earth, what we're seeing is the manifestation of his unmanifested pastimes. The pure emotions that exist in the spiritual world are being displayed on earth. Premanjana churita bhakti vilochanena santaksa daiva hridayeshu vilokayanti. Those whose eyes are smeared with the salve of love, they always see him in their heart of hearts. So he's there always. This is what I was saying before. It's not that it's not that everything is Krishna. Not that we can say, all right, why worship Krishna? We can worship this chair. It's also eternal. It's the absolute truth. No. We have to follow the authorized instructions how to worship Krishna. And the pure devotees who have seen Krishna in perfect trance, right? Veda Vyas, he described the Srimad on the order of divine order of Narada Muni, then he went into perfect trance and he saw Krishna perfectly and he saw Krishna's material energy and everything, and then he composed the Srimad Bhagavatam to direct us so that we can also see Krishna, so that we can also get that pure devotion, that salve of love that lets us really see Krishna. And that's the great, and that's why we study this great Srimad Bhagavatam. It's greater than all the other Vedic scriptures that he wrote, because it doesn't have any encouragement for us to try to enjoy, to get something. We'll do some religion and then we'll get some benefit from it. But the Srimad Bhagavatam is actually disclosing the real eternal religion of all jivas, which is you don't have any separate benefit from pleasing Krishna. That's your highest benefit.
Yeah.
If you speak there, is it on? Then people
it's
in the kitchen
now. Yeah,
and also people
now.
Who are watching
yeah.
on the internet can hear. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember it's my personal experience. I don't have internet. I don't have, any other big technology information with me. But my childhood was, we used to chant mantras and prayers at school, and we didn't know the meaning of that. And when we write down or read out the poets, the great poets, and Krishna's, Raskhans and all those, Ravidas, Jammaras, mm-hmm. and then we used to write only the Vyakaran, grammars, corrections. Uh-huh. But those things are stored in our brain. Mm-hmm. The normal human brain is like that, You may not feel that time, but more wiser you are, more older you are, you're getting wider knowledge if you want to. Or it's your luck, good luck. I think you are lucky enough if you go through those. The same thing happened to me now, these days, 45 years old rhyme is giving the real illustration of what does that mean.
Mm.
So no book, no, I think.
Yeah, those of you from India are so fortunate that your land has been blessed with these great saints. and this great Sanskrit Vedic literature, and then those who've explained it, and you grow up learning about that stuff. I was reading one interview recently where Prabhupada was being interviewed by, he was in some airport or some, so, or maybe he was in the temple, but some newspaper reporter was interviewing him, and he was trying to pin down, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you telling people to leave their religion? He was saying, I'm not telling people to leave their religion. I'm saying, here is religion. You know, want to love God? Anything that's effective for that, it loves God. So the guy was then saying, well, how are you, how well is your organization doing in India? Are you respected in India? And he said, oh yes, when I was in India, I was having pandals every day. There was 20 or 30,000 people coming daily for 1 week. And he said, and Prabhupada said, the situation in India is this, that people in India, they're very naturally disposed to like Krishna and spiritual life, but the leaders are trying to make them chase after the material,
exactly,
you know.
Exactly.
So, but anyway, so all these things that you, so you hear these mantras, they're powerful, even, you know, they're very powerful, and most powerful is Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. And these names of God are very, very, very powerful. So now Lord Chaitanya has come and he said to everyone, all right, it's Kali Yuga, you can't really be great, you know, sit in lotus position for hours and don't eat anything and meditate and fix your mind. But you don't have to do that. This is Kali Yuga. And if everyone just chants Hare Krishna, they can actually get the highest thing, the bhav of bhakti. Mm-hmm. So then he said to everyone, now let's go out and get everyone chanting that name so we can make the whole world as fortunate as India, that you have this opportunity to read Srimad Bhagavatam and to understand Krishna, really understand Krishna, and not try to make some, you know, the Mayavadi interpretation, unfortunately, it undermines the real effect of Srimad Bhagavatam. Lord Chaitanya told people, don't touch that interpretation that tries to make the Vedic scriptures appear like an atheistic philosophy to satisfy the mentality of those who don't actually feel, because of envious of Krishna, they don't feel like worshipping him and loving and adoring him. Lord Brahma doesn't feel like that. He's the author of the Vedas, right? He's saying, I adore Govinda. So that's why we're singing this hymn, too. We should get on. We're taking too long. We don't have to read the whole purport, I think, because we're taking too long. Let's go to the Nama Ashtakam.